The Open Door of Emptiness. Chapter 2. Love and Impermanence. Part 4. Defining Others and Being Defined by Others. The more we experience ourselves as an unfolding process and see how there is no fixed essence or substance to ourselves, the more we see that the same applies to other people. People are not things. They are not discrete entities, despite the fact that when we notice people, we clock their physical shape and how they stand and move in the environment so clearly that they seem to be separated from it. We are certainly not in a fixed location in the environment, like a tree or a lamppost, yet, nonetheless, we are always in the environment. We are always somewhere. Our somewhereness is part of how we show in our different forms, our different moods of closeness or distance. We are dynamic, energetic forms moving in a field of energy. You can't get other people. They are not commodities, even though some may be trafficked for sexual purposes, for cheap labour, and so on. There are many subtle forms of slavery. To enslave someone is to limit their freedom. The first thing that you need to do is to collapse their dignity. In the old days, when there were public slave markets, the slaves were often displayed naked. They had no way to hide. Everyone else was clothed, and they were naked. From observing family structures, we know that often, when the parents are very invasive and judgmental, the child feels exposed, that they have nowhere to hide, and they can collapse inside. When you collapse inside, the heart sinks and the spine becomes weak. The rigidity of the skeleton is not in dialogue with the wonderful, soft, pliable nature of muscle and skin. If you become too plastic as a person, you become moulded by circumstances. So such children often get bullied when they go to school. They have gone under the power of the idea that somebody else is able to define them. Usually, in that kind of structure, what people are saying to you is that you are useless, that you are ugly, that you are stupid, and so on. However, if someone tells you that you are wonderful, you are beautiful, you are amazing, that is also a form of enslavement. You exist, and I can, in my perception of you, know you so well that I can come to a conclusion about you. In terms of the content of the communication, it may sound quite positive. You are so beautiful. But implicit in that is that if you stop being beautiful, I won't like you. So when someone says, you are so beautiful, you should give them the bill for all the face creams and makeup you use to maintain your beauty. Either way, criticism or praise, you are being bound into an image, and that always has its difficulties. What we have been looking at is how our embodied existence is shifting according to circumstances. We are available and then unavailable. We are happy to meet and then maybe not so happy, but we want to feel safe with the other person. Child development therapists speak about the need of what they call object constancy. They say that if the behaviour of the parent is predictable, If the child has meals at regular times, gets up early and goes to bed early, this creates predictable rhythms which allows the child a sense of security in the world. Nevertheless, other people are not always reliable. And, as an adult, if I still feel that my security and happiness depends on another person, then in order for me to feel safe, the other person has to behave in certain ways which I can anticipate and rely on. Such people often become very jealous. Why are you looking at that woman? Do you like her better than me? This kind of insecurity is really telling the other person, their partner, that they have to control their life and their world and not respond to circumstances in a way which makes them less predictable. So we end up with this attachment: I love you because you're the one I need so that I can be me. I need you so that I can feel like me. You make me feel like me. I don't feel like me if you are not there. This is the situation of a 3-year-old child. When mama is not available, anxiety arises. The child only settles when it is child plus mama. Many people retain the same structure as adults. They have never planted themselves vertically. They are not centered and grounded where they are, in whatever circumstances. They are structurally off balance and looking for someone else to keep them upright. It need not be another person. It could be alcohol, an intense habit form like anorexia, bulimia, self-harming, or getting into abusive relationships. These can function as self-soothing activities. Although they are disturbing as well, they are ways of trying to settle oneself when one is upset or overwhelmed by what is going on. I use you to make me feel okay, and so my relationship with you is that you are a means to an end. Such a relationship is functional in terms of a psychological need. So if I say, I love you, it may sound as if this is just about you, but it is actually disguising the fact that I love you because of the function that you play in maintaining my sense of self. I have incorporated you into my sense of self. This is what small children do with their mothers. The mother is like an artificial limb for the child. Mama becomes part of me. Mama is like an additional brain outside of oneself. Small children communicate like that a lot. However, if this dependent attachment is carried over into adult life, then it makes the deeper spiritual independence unattainable because I have become so dependent on someone else that I have lost my integrity. When two people collapse onto each other, it is sometimes described as an A-frame relationship. An alternative, healthier form is described as an H-frame relationship, where two people are grounded in themselves, yet linked. They can get close and fuse and separate and do whatever they need to do and meet together again later. There is the sense of, here I am, and I am with you. If somebody goes away and their partner asks, did you miss me? Hopefully one can respond, no, I was fully doing whatever I was doing. Why would I miss you? I hope you didn't miss me. However, this doesn't sound very romantic. Alone, yet not lonely. If you want to be mindful and present, you are mindful and present with what is showing. If the beloved is far away, then what is showing is something different. You do your work, or you talk with a friend, you are there. Paul Liang sang. This is tragic. Ridiculous. Why would you want to lose part of yourself? Projecting your life into other people creates a pseudo-closeness, a fusion which denies the fact that you are born alone, you live alone, and you die alone. You might be married to someone for 50 years and spend every night in the same bed, and yet you are alone. Alone is not necessarily lonely. If you are at home and at peace in yourself, what is lacking? Lacking gives the sense that something is missing. The basis of my presence as this form in the world is the openness of the mind. Awareness is infinite. Although I say my awareness, it is not my possession. Awareness is the mother of me. I emerge within the field of awareness as a movement of energy with other movements of energy. And if I don't forget the ground, then the open spaciousness of the mind is always available. So we can be relaxed and at ease, and then, without losing the spaciousness, we manifest interpersonally, getting close to people, engaging in different ways for a while. What do we need? We need contact. Because contact is where we experience the non-duality of self and other. But if I need you, then we have duality. I am separate here. You are there. With your qualities. I need you. I need you because I know you are so good for me. That is not something to be believed. That is the imagination. Why? Because you are unreliable. You mutate. You change. You are not a stone. Hopefully, this is true for all of us. If you want something immutable, marry a stone. People are always shifting and changing. You can enjoy contact, but you never get another person. Relationships go wrong when we start to collapse on each other. I built my world around you. Why? Why would you do that? You are the basis of my existence. This is ludicrous, laughable. How could you be the basis of my existence? That is an idea of fusion. When you put food in your mouth, my stomach doesn't get filled. Oh, James, you just don't understand these things. It's a feeling. I need you. What do you need? Me? What do you know about me? Me is what you imagine. I can tell you 10 things about me that would make you run away. But I won't. I need you so much. It's a bit of a cover-up, the drama of romantic love. This is not to say that we shouldn't fall in love. Some of us can't help falling in love. But if you can catch it in the moment, it is a movement of energy. It is a wish to engage in a dance, to have co-emergence, to have synergy. It may not last very long, but it's very fulfilling and life-affirming. Just as you don't know what sensations will arise in your body or what thoughts will arise in your mind, Other people are also unpredictable. So when we say, I love you, this implies that there is a reliable you to be loved. I will always be there for you. Sometimes you're not available because you're just not in the mood. Romantic love is transformed into devotion. In Buddhism, when we recite, I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, we are taking refuge in the idea of the possibility of liberation, of being free of reliance on hopes and fears. We open into the path by becoming aware of the limitation of our deluded notion that we exist as a thing. I am not a thing. You are not a thing. Taking refuge means awakening to how we are, but first, we have to be able to look. We say that love is blind, and when you are blind, you don't see too much. In tantric practice, romantic love is transformed into devotion. Our longing for another who saves us is removed from the human domain and centered on a deity. It could be a peaceful deity like Tara, or a dancing deity like Vajrayogini. There are many types of deities out there. When you have a connection with the practice, you always have access to the deity. They won't betray you or let you down. You might betray them because you'll possibly forget to do the practice. You start with the high idea that you will do the practice every day, and then it becomes once a week, and then once a month. But the deity is always there, available. They don't need you. You need them. You need them in order to find out how not to need. Then you are free. That is the tantric transformation of the desperation of devotion into the dissolving of the whole mandala into emptiness. We are social creatures. We live together. And so surely we can help one another. That is a good idea. But help each other to do what? To be grounded and centered? To live with dignity? To find out more about how we are? To be curious? To work with circumstances? To work with how inner feelings and outer situations change? These are all important tasks, but they are not linked with romantic love. The most important thing between people is workability. One way of describing how we relate with others is chakra energy. We have genital energy, the drive towards seeking the other. We have the energy of the navel, which is the point where the inner duality of subject and object meet. We have chakras in the heart, the throat, between the eyes, and in the top of the head. We might meet someone and have a very strong sexual connection, but no real heart connection. We might have a very playful energy from the navel, but no real communication in terms of discussion or conversation. The possibilities of our relating are not volitional. You find someone sexually interesting or not. It arises as a kind of given in the interplay of your embodiment. With some people, you might have a lot to say. With other people, you smile at them, but there is nothing much to say. Our connectivity is revealed through our participation together. And this availability shifts and changes. Thinking like this may help us have more sense that the other is not an object, is not a thing. We cannot appropriate a person. We can be open to be with them in some way for a while. To live like that, we have to be honest, because when different aspects of our embodiment engage with the other person, they may fit, but later on, they may not fit. If you come home and have a conversation like this with your partner, "Something's happened today, and I really need to tell you all about it." "Well, I really need not to hear about it." "But I thought you were interested in me." "Yeah, well, I am, sort of, sometimes." "Only sometimes? No, that's no good. I want you there, all the time, fully available on my terms." Now, this is a violence. It's not a personal violence. It's not that you're being really horrible to each other. It's the structural violence of you not living with the freshness of energy. If you want a reliable thing, run some water from the tap, fill up the ice tray, put it in the freezer, and tomorrow you have little ice cubes. They have a definite shape. If you say to them, "I love you," they just sit there. But when the ice starts to melt, it flows out. Water is without inherent shape. It takes on shape according to circumstances. We are like water, fire, and wind. We have the earth element, but it is not dominant, so we shift and move. To expect always to have synchronicity of your energy with another person's is a very big ask. This is why Buddhism identifies grasping and challenges the expectation that there are things to get, and that having got them, you can hold on to them. People change. We all change. How to live with that? We have to be fresh. How to be fresh? Dissolve into the space, which is the ground of your being. How will I do that? By not grasping at yourself. Grasping at self as something is exactly the twin of grasping at other as something. Your self-knowledge is the delusion. You wrap yourself in stories about yourself, but rather than revealing who you are, this is how you hide yourself from yourself and from other people. Our life is based on, "Let's see. What shall we do on Saturday night?" "Let's see. Maybe you'll be tired. Maybe I'll be tired. But we need to make plans." "Make a plan with an ice cube, then. I don't know how I will be by Saturday night." A plan is a violence. The future hasn't come. And the future you imagine is unlikely to come. You will get a future, but it won't be the one you thought you were going to get. And you won't be who you are now when the future does arrive. Who you are now will have dissolved. Does that mean we don't know anything? We know how to stay relaxed and hopeful and responsive. We know how to work with circumstances, not to enslave other people in order to feel free ourselves. How would I know what to do? You won't know what to do. You don't need to know what to do. You will do something. But maybe I'll do the wrong thing. That is okay. Then you say sorry. If you make too many plans, you become extended out into the future. In order to survive financially, We often need to do the kind of work that involves planning, which is based on the mechanization of human beings. We are expected to function in a mechanized way. Every month, we need to submit our report. We have to do this, and we have to do that. Have to? If you're taking it up willingly, as your adult dignity, then fine. But if this have to is imposed on you, then it is a kind of violence. Computers and logarithms are prefiguring the shape of things. What keeps us fresh is inquiry, living on the growing edge of our existence, moment by moment. When we feel very alive, it is usually because we are feeling life just manifesting as us. Our life, our vitality, our presence is here, revealing itself as us in this moment. So, to relate to other people in that way, we don't need to ask them to preform themselves in order to fit into some template. We're very far from that in our culture nowadays. In the old days, when we were taking in the harvest, using a scythe, doing heavy physical work, there would be breaks in the day, and the quaffing of beer, and the singing of harvesting songs. It would be an organic process. Tractors don't have organic processes. They have deadlines to bring things to the factories or to the markets. Forgetfulness or a lack of mindfulness can be a blessing sometimes. If we were more aware of the violence of our structures, we would be very unhappy. This unhappiness manifests as depression, anxiety, eating disorders, addictions, and so on. These are symptoms manifesting in the individual, but actually the problem is structural and pervasive. We have created an inhumane world, and we are starting to see the consequences. We don't know when to stop because we don't see what we are doing. To set fire to the Amazonian jungle is quite a thing. Huge trees burn down. So many birds and animals burn. They are sacrificed for the idea that it is of benefit to grow soya beans and maize. The maize is for the pigs, to make them fat, so that fat people can get even fatter. The intoxication by idea allows you not to see what is right in front of your eyes. Likewise, at work, your boss may have an idea and wants you to make it into a project. You have to do it. Next week, he will have another idea. And another, and another. Each project involves you projecting yourself into the future. You have displaced yourself from here to there. You take your mind out of your body and you put it into the future. Many of us are disembodied in this way. One aim in meditation practices can be to re-inhabit your body. Only by actually being in your body can you start to know how the five elements are working as the body. A demand to do something is like wind and earth. Something solid is being propelled at you, like the roof of a house blown off in a hurricane and flying towards you. Wind needs space. As long as the hurricane is over the ocean, it doesn't cause too much trouble. But when it hits the island, then the trouble begins. The mind needs space because the agitation of life sets up these various winds which operate through the prana channel. How will I find the space? We are always in space. Space is our mother. The space we move in is the form of the womb of the Great Mother. It is empty, and within the space, all these energetic forms arise without inherent existence. They are here, and then they vanish. Mental formations make them important and serious. We can loosen this. We can work hard. We can do many different things, but in a very relaxed and easy way. To strive and push yourself is not so good. Energy arises from space. Thoughts arise from the open, empty mind. So we're experiencing energy as the play of the wind in the open sky allows you to move easily as required. And the more you can do that, the less exhausted you are, the less in need of compensation. This means that you can relate to other people without having your need, your hunger, and your emptiness as your calling card. The open emptiness of the mind is not a lack. It is the basis of every experience arising to fill the space of the mind. Lack arises when the individual ego marks out territory with a boundary and then operates as an import-export agency, trading with the environment as if it were something outer. But we are in the environment. We are of the environment. The open ground shows the non-dual field of subject and object arising together, within which, moment by moment, we take on different forms, connecting us in different ways. From that basis, relating to other people is much easier, because if you're sensitive to your own situation, if you appreciate the qualities of the many different factors of your life, then you can start to appreciate other people. When you sit in meditation, your mind may be very excited or anxious or dull. Do not enter into judgment. Don't try to change the situation. Just be with the mind as it is. I am dull. I am having a full cup of dullness, a full cup of anxiety, a full cup of loneliness, a full cup of, I am wasting my time meditating because I can't do it. Whatever is arising, if you stay with it, it will give you its whole flavour. This is how the energy of the Buddha's heart shows itself. Ordinary hopes and fears. Hopes come, fears come. For the ego, hopes are better than fears. But for awareness, it is all just stuff. One no better than the other. Happy, sad, in love, in grief, arising and passing, arising and passing. The more we are relaxed in the open spaciousness of awareness, the less demand we put on other people to conform to the image that we have of the ideal person who makes us feel safe. Finding this unborn ground of our own being is very helpful for being intimate with others. Teaching given in Warsaw over the 14th to 15th of December 2019. Edited by Barbara Terrace and James Lowe. From the book The Open Door of Emptiness by James Lowe. Read by Wendy, April 2025.